Good afternoon. So, last time, we started off by talking about set user ID programs. We've mentioned before that these are a way that usually the system administrator can give ordinary users access to functionality that normally they aren't allowed to do. Like, they can let them mount a USB stick and access his files on it, even though ordinarily the user would not be allowed to make the system calls that, you know, set up file systems, because we reserve that towards sort of special users like root or super user. And we can provide sort of selective access to that functionality with a set user ID program. But we learned that, well, writing set user ID programs is actually very difficult to do securely, because in a set user ID program, the person running it has an exceptional amount of control over the environment, and they can create all sorts of weird situations that you never would think of happening in a normal program. And you have to deal with those. We also talked about one specific sort of fallacy which happens when people are writing things like set user ID programs, where you're doing something on behalf of another user. Commonly something you'll do is that you'll say, okay, the user wants to access, say, this file. Are they allowed to access that file? And if so, let's do that. And this pattern has this problem that we check at one point, are they allowed to access this thing? And then we actually access the thing at a different point. And in between those two points, well, the thing we were checking could be different than the thing we actually access, even though it has the same name or address. And with files, we saw this happening because we'd say, okay, is this a normal file? Yes, it is. Then we'd actually open it up. And by the time we open it up, the file with that name was not a normal file anymore. Instead, it was an alias for something else. And we saw that a fix for this sort of was that, well, we should just do the access, you know, with the same permissions as the normal user would have. And POSIX sort of has a mechanism for set user ID programs to temporarily switch back to the original user, precisely to allow patterns like this. That, you know, in our example, we have, if you want to print something out, we want to open the thing we're printing out with the permissions of the user who started the program, even though we might need extra permissions to do the printing. So we need a way of temporarily switching back to that user. Then after we finished talking about these things with access control lists, where we sort of had information alongside files and other things indicating what programs were allowed to access them, and in what ways, mentioned sort of a different strategy. And this is where, rather than having that information be on the side, and meaning that every time we implement sort of system calls and the like which access things, we need to add this additional check that, oh, does the access control list say this is okay? Instead, we have this notion that we're going to control access to things by controlling when you get a token that lets you access something. So you'll access these things with these sort of access tokens called capabilities. And if you have a valid token, that means you have permission to access things. And a way these tokens might work might look something like sort of file descriptors, that we know that your file descriptor is valid because we have a table attached to your process which says, what are the file descriptors you have? And if you want to access, you know, read from a file that's not on that table, well, too bad. There's no way of specifying that file with read. You have to create an access token for it first somehow. And we mentioned that we can extend this to things more than files by just providing something file descriptor-like for other resources and, you know, and sort of equivalent calls that use those file descriptor-like entities to access it. So we saw the example with capsaicin and their idea, oh, you have a file descriptor to represent a process. So when you want to kill a process or wait for it, use that file descriptor rather than the process ID that's sort of a global ID. And rather than the system needing to check, oh, are you allowed to kill this process, it would say, does your file descriptor for a process say you're allowed to kill it? And the sort of big advantage of this scheme, this capability-based scheme, is that the token lookup is the permissions check. That we don't have this sort of separate information on the side. We know we are allowed to access it because of that token itself. We don't have to have some separate tracking for that. And finally, we talked about a different topic briefly, mentioning about virtual machines. And we mentioned there there are lots of ways of emulating virtual machines. We talked about emulating virtual machines where we run things directly on the hardware and wouldn't have special hardware support. And the basic scheme we had was called trap and emulate, that we'd run the guest operating system, and it would try to do things that, well, you can't do in user mode normally. Like, you can't access devices. And when we normal program does that on our normal operating system, that's not a virtual machine monitor, it's not trying to be something like VirtualBox, well, that program's going to crash because, you know, you're not allowed to access devices. And what we'll do instead is we'll catch the exception, well, handle, I should say, the exception that would cause that crash. And rather than crashing the program, crashing the guest to us, we're going to simulate what that instruction that it's not allowed to do would do. So, like, if it's doing the instructions that would read from the keyboard, we're going to figure out, read from the keyboard on its behalf, and put the result in a place where it would normally get it from the keyboard device. Those are things we covered last time. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So as I mentioned at the end of last lecture, our primary topic today is going to be exam review. It's going to be questions you have. First, to get some questions on logistics out of the way, this is the draft of the instructions for the final. Might change a little bit. Generally, going to use the quiz system. We're going to look at the comments field more than we do for a typical quiz. So if you want partial credit, you better have your work in there. It's open book, open notes. You can use any resources created before the exam opened. Don't like ask questions on Stack Overflow or similar sites, or look for other people who did so. But if it was created before the exam opened, it's fine. And it's to be done individually. So that's basic logistical stuff about head off. Just kind of category questions. And with that, I'll take, what do you want me to talk about with for exam review? Just take things you want me to talk about. If there's nothing, we'll just finish. Yeah. When does XV6 decide to schedule something? Okay. Yes.
Process versus thread control block.
Okay. Yeah. Context switch versus exception. Okay. What's the quiz number? Since that's how I guess week 4 quiz. Okay. Yeah. Semaphores versus mutexes. Okay. Device controllers and anything more specific? Versus. Okay. 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 Yeah.
Kernel responsibilities.
Okay. Okay. Anything more specific or? Okay. Okay. Which are about. For transactions, okay. Anything else? Yeah. Which is about.
Number of page tables needed for.
Okay. Okay. Switchers. Okay, so let's group these. Anything else? Are we all set for? Okay. So, kernel responsibility. So the hardware has decided that certain things only happen, are only done by the OS, and it arranges, it makes it so the OS can arrange for only its code to run in kernel mode. And we call that code the kernel. And typical things typically reserved for the OS is setting how exceptions are handled. Well, handling exceptions themselves, setting the page table base pointer, communicating with devices. In the Unix design, sort of information about processes, I/O, etc., is all managed by the kernel. We didn't talk about it, but there are other OS designs which maybe have less managed by the kernel. But sort of the fundamental limitation is that the hardware has decided certain things are kernel only. Kernel mode only, or OS only, kernel mode. So let's talk about context switches versus exceptions. So if we're talking about a thread, context switch means switching from one thread to another. And a thread is sort of, is our virtual processor. So has its own, oh right, I should do that a second. Registers and program counter. So if we're switching that, and it's sort of that virtual processor idea where it looks like it's executing as sort of one thing in a processor switching to another, that's a context switch. So an exception means that we run OS code to handle some event. And, yes. And the OS code can decide to do a context switch. All right, but I guess to clarify, this code is kind of like a function call to handle the event. Like, we aren't switching to something that previously exists, we're just like calling a function to handle the event. It's a very special call because it's done by the hardware directly. And the OS code can decide to do a context switch if it wants, or it can just handle the event and go back to what happened before the exception happened. Exception. Yes.
The function call that's being made, is that pretty much the same call?
So, question of the function call. So, this is what the hardware is doing. So, the hardware jumps to the OS code, locations configured at boot with the processor, and switches to kernel mode. And that's it making a function call. But it looks like a function call, though it's not called the same way as a normal function is. Is that? Okay, so context versus mode switches. So when we talk about a thread or a process context switch, we're changing what thread, and therefore which set of registers, and or what process
So memory, file, open files, etc. are active. A mode switch usually means kernel versus user mode. We're just changing whether we're in kernel or user mode. Kernel or user mode. Often this involves saving, restoring registers, saving or restoring registers, but we're usually saving registers when we enter kernel mode, like we would save registers when entering a function. Function and restoring registers when we exit kernel mode, like we restore registers when leaving a function, like that sort of thing, versus a context switch, versus a thread context switch, where we typically save the old registers and restore the new ones, not like a function. Like a function, we have specific registers to switch to. So typically when we're entering kernel, like have a exception handler run, like, we're just making new register values like a function call. Like we save the registers because we're using them for something else, but we aren't like restoring a specific set of values for them. And a mode switch is usually kind of looks like a function call as far as what we're doing, except of course the processor runs with this extra operations enabled while we're switched to kernel mode. And I guess with that, probably process versus thread control block is really fit. Yes?
So a mode switch is essentially just a system call, correct?
So mode switch is a switch from user to kernel mode. So this happens on more than happens. Mode switch happens on any switch happens on most exceptions, because the event that triggers the exception usually occurs when a program is in user mode, but the exception is always handled in kernel mode. So that includes system calls, but it also includes like page faults. It includes I/O, like key presses triggering the kernel to run. Those all trigger remote switches. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Is network part of I/O? Yes. So process versus thread control block. So thread is, as mentioned above, virtual processor. So it has its own registers and program counter. A process sort of is one or more threads, so virtual processors, plus sort of files to represent I/O devices. So it's kind of process like a virtual machine, I/O devices plus memory, so an address space. So a process, therefore, for address space has its own page table and other information about memory layout, e.g. in XV6, sort of the end of heap, or in Linux, the list of maps. But some sort of information to track what's in the memory. We have our open files, and what directory we're in, that's part of the process control block. And we also have one or more thread control blocks. And I guess the point of confusion here, so its stack pointer register points to a memory location that's part of the process's address space. Typically, a stack is allocated for each
thread, but every thread in the process can access that stack if it has a pointer to it. Like it won't do it like for a function call because that will mess up the other thread, but it can. And so it's not like tracked separately with the thread control block typically. At least not something the kernel needs to worry about. So, questions on process thread? Yes.
And how do you limit cross-thread stack accesses?
How do we limit cross-thread stack accesses? When new stacks are allocated, I guess the question is, what do you mean by limit? So the thread is always started with the stack pointer pointing to the correct stack. So it won't access other thread stacks normally. And, the threading library, whatever starts the thread, choose different address ranges for each new stack. Each stack, often with some invalid pages around it, so stack overflows crash, which prevents the most common type of sort of accidentally touching another thread stack. But this could happen deliberately, so like if I pass a pointer from one thread to another, I can still access the stack. But one thread can pass a pointer to another. So it could deliberately access another thread stack. And we saw some examples of that in lecture, like where we started a thread and passed a pointer to our current thread stack when we did that. Yeah. Thread share all the memory. And it's just the question of do they have pointers to the same thing, which they can.
So threads within the process have the illusion that they all have the same memory.
Threads within the process have the illusion they all have the same memory, yes. And typically this is achieved by giving them all the same page table.
Well, processes each have their own page table.
And a process each has its own page table, yes. So yeah, a thread's page table is determined by what process it's a part of. Answer your question? Anything else on thread versus process control blocks? Okay, so then there's the question of when does Xv6 decide to schedule something? So Xv6, the supplied scheduler in Xv6 is run when a thread becomes non-runnable. So, e.g., waiting in read or sleep or similar system calls. When a timer interrupt goes off. That just triggers the scheduler, and that is pretty much it. And I guess there's a special case when the yield system call runs it. So it's a yield system call which invokes the scheduler, but doesn't actually make the thread runnable. So those are the cases where a scheduler runs, and when the scheduler runs, Xv6's default scheduler just chooses the next thing in the process table. Going to the back to the beginning if there's nothing left. I guess just to say the next thing means next runnable thing. So it doesn't try to run things that can't, that are marked as runnable, like they're waiting for key pressers. Yes. The question, how does it choose the next thing? It has a pointer to the current process. It goes, advances that pointer by one, and sees if that's runnable and keeps going.
So does that pointer, when you add stuff to that pointer, is it chronologically or just?
So it's just, this question, is that chronological? That's based on the location in the process table array. Which is not, things got in that location in the process table array because when you fork, it chooses the next available entry, but there's not otherwise anything systematic about how that choice is made. Okay. Other questions about when things are scheduled? Okay, so let's do... I guess I should check this here. Okay. So then we have quiz 4, week 2. Let me find 3 data. Quiz 4, week 2. Okay. So quiz 4, week 2, we were, and it was question 2. So quiz 4 week 2 was asking the scenario in that quiz. I guess I should actually pull up the quiz. Was asking about this code, and the purpose of this code was to send things as uppercase from one process to another. Okay, all right, window. So this question, the goal was to run program A, send the output to something which converts its output to uppercase into program B. And in the code we have here, the code to convert to uppercase is down here. So we need to arrange for this code to read from program A and write to program B. Because here's our conversion to uppercase. And there's not any other way in this code for that to happen. And question 2 is asking what goes in blank 4. So blank 4 needs to read from program A. So here is program A is run, and we know pipefds of 1's right end, because that's index 1, is standard out of program A. So program A's output goes to pipefds 1. That means we can read it from pipefds 0. So that means that we need to have pipefds 0. So program A's output goes to pipefds 1. Because the dupe 2 changes standard out, then question 2 asks, what do we read from to convert that to, to get what we want to convert to uppercase. Bottom, 1, 4. Rates to so blank. And so that's going to be pipefds of 0. And I have that helpfully written down here. So questions about? Yes.
Okay.
is the that's the right end of pipefd is one. I did this wrong. Right end of the pipe created by pipe is one. 0, which is the read end of that pipe.
And all Dune 2 does is it takes the second argument and has whatever it's with the second argument of Dune 2 write the first argument.
It makes the final descriptor identified by the second argument. So what does Duke 2 do? Duke 2 XY makes the file descriptor identified by Y go to where the file descriptor identified by X currently goes. Does that answer your question? Okay. Then about question on semaphores versus mutexes. So mutexes are a type of lock. Right. So they have two operations. So they're a type of lock. So they have a lock operation and a lock, which is wait for the lock be available. Then mark it as taken, as locked, and unlock, mark the lock as available. As locked, mark it as locked, not letting anyone else have it. So we have that mutual exclusion that locks give a mutual exclusion. Operations. And mutexes, unlike some other types of locks we discussed, always wait, or generally wait without using tons of CPU time. Processor time. Meaning that there implies that they are somehow integrated with the scheduler. Let the scheduler know, it's waiting for this lock, don't run it right now. So semaphores are more general than mutexes. So semaphores, and we talked about what were called counting semaphores in lecture. That's the only type of semaphores we talked about. So a semaphore stores a non-negative number. We have a down operation is wait for the number to be positive, then decrement it. And the up operation is increment the number. And it turns out we can simulate mutexes, or I guess I should say we can implement mutexes with semaphores using lock is semaphore initially is the value 1. And then lock is semaphore down. And unlock is semaphore up. So semaphores can do everything mutexes can do. We can also do other things with semaphores. For example, we can wait for something to happen, which is hard to do with mutexes. Semaphore 0 and wait for thing is sem down, and mark thing happened is sem up. And that's something that's not possible with mutexes because typically the unlock operation requires that you locked it previously. This thread. Current thread, I should say. Be more specific than you. The current thread locked it previously. And we mentioned that typically, if we're using mutexes and we want to do this sort of waiting for things operation, we use an additional thing called condition variables to handle that waiting for something operation. Questions about semaphores versus mutexes? Yeah. So mutexes are a type of lock, spin locks are another type of lock. Mutexes have this property that they don't wait for a lot of processor time, which spin locks do not. So the question is, Xv6 mostly uses spin locks. Xv6 has something that's more like mutexes that it can use, but it mostly uses spin locks. Yeah?
What are the differences in implementation between mutexes and spin locks?
What are the differences between implementation and mutexes and spin locks? So the big thing that mutexes need is that they need to have some sort of integration with the scheduler. So we can use the spin lock idea like to make sure that we actually have like two things happening independently, right? That they don't like that if we're, you know, they're not interfering with each other. But as far as like waiting for a long period of time, mutexes better have some sort of integration with the scheduler to make that happen, which spin locks would not. Like spin locks, when they want to wait for a long time, are just going to check the lock over and over again using lots of compute time. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think I'm just a little confused about some of the assembly parts.
Okay, so yeah, so the integration with the scheduler, this doesn't mean, so common implementation technique is that mutexes will use spin locks that use a lot of processor time, but only to see if they need to wait. But actual waiting will involve calling the scheduler. Is that clear what you're getting at, or? Yeah, so they're going to use spin locks to like check if they need to wait and all that, but the actual waiting has to be integrated with the scheduler. And this also means that the unlock operation, you know, implies that the unlock operation needs to work with the scheduler to make something runnable that was previously not. Other semaphore versus mutexes questions? Yes.
So like a multi-threaded program with like two threads waiting on the lock, they determine like the order of which like the next receives it by like whichever thread starts like the waiting queue.
So the question is, if we have two threads waiting a lock, how do we determine which thread goes next? So we would hope with a lock that's integrated with the scheduler that we'd have the typical design, we would have some explicit list of threads that are waiting and we could choose one from that using whatever criteria we wanted. You know, just however the queue is ordered. And that would generally be true. In sort of quarter cases, the order might not be so well defined because, for example, let's say I unlock the lock exactly as two different threads are trying to lock it. In that case, the order in which those threads get the lock might depend on exactly what the timing is of when they try to lock it, because they won't be on the queue yet. Does that answer your question? Yes, so usually once threads decide to wait, there is some queue of waiting threads that unlock can take threads from. And yeah, have it. But if they haven't decided to wait yet, the order is still kind of like spin locks, depends on exactly how the system, you know, very precise timing things. Other questions on semaphores, mutexes? Okay, so next. Okay, fork efficiency. So sort of the naive implementation of fork is copy all the program's memory. And the better implementation is avoid copying the program's memory as long as possible. Instead, instead, mark the memory. Mark both copies, both pretend copies, which aren't really copies. As read-only, but don't actually make a copy. Then, when the program, when something tries to access one of the copies, actually copy, and perhaps, and you know, some part enough for that access to work. At least a page with page tables. Copy at least enough for that access to work. So this was called copy on write. All right, and this makes fork less hideously inefficient. We still have to copy a bunch of stuff, but we're not copying most of the stuff for the program. And with fork, often we will end up never copying a lot of things that we would otherwise copy. So we're, even better than just deferring the copy. But it's not that we're gonna have the copy eventually, but we're just delaying it. In fact, we will often never actually have to do the copy, because the program will exit before it tries to use all of the copies. Questions about that? Okay, so then quiz 9, quiz 7, question 4? That's what it was? Okay. Where is my window for this? Here, okay. Quiz 7. Okay, so in this question we have, that's not the one I wanted. So in this question we have a program that has this memory layout, and with 4 kilobyte pages, we know that the bottom 12 bits are the page offset. So our virtual page numbers here are 0 to 3, then 4 and 5, and 7FFE through 7FFF. And those are the things we actually have to access. And if we think of our two-level page table structure, so we have VPNs 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and FFE, then FFF. So those are our VPNs, and we need to figure out what the two-level page table structure looks like for this. So the key is, what does our two-level page table structure look like for this? So, and we're going to have a first level table. We have our first index is, VPN index 0 is VPN 0 through 3FF. How do we know that? Because this is, all VPNs with the first 10 bits 0. Why the first 10 bits 0? Because that's index 0. Because index 1 is going to be OX3FF through OX400 like 7FF, which is all VPNs with first 10 bits, 1, because we use the first 10 bits to index into that first level table. So this is going to point to a second level table, and index 0 is going to be for VPN 0, index 1 is going to be for VPN 1, and so on. And then, much later on, we're going to have some index I'm not going to bother computing, but that's going to include the page for the stack. Two pages for the stack. It's going to end at 7FF, and therefore going to be 0x7400FF. And this is going to point to a different second level table. So this is the second level table for 0 through 3FF. And this is for F, and at the bottom of this table, so index E, we have VPN 0x7 E. So 3F. And I do F, we have F. So we have the page table, we have the page table entries for. So I have a first level page table, plus two second level page tables. What about all the other entries? Well, if we think of our index one, we don't have any virtual pages in this range, so this is just going to be marked as not present. So we don't need a second level page table for that range. Two second level page tables don't need other second level page tables. We just mark that whole range of VPNs not present in the first level. So that's how we get three tables, and each table on XV6 is one page. One page, so that implies three pages or page tables. So questions? Figuring that out. I'll correct the underlining here. Also, after that. Okay, so then about device controllers. So the big idea with device controllers is that processors know how to talk to memory. Memory is already not on the same chip. Let's just use that functionality to also talk to devices, talk to other things. And so the solution is, so hardware implements the memory sort of interface, but makes it do things relevant to a device. So for example, a keyboard controller sort of exposes memory locations, but rather than storing data, these memory locations let the processor access the keyboard. So that's the big idea behind device controllers, is that, oh, we already have this mechanism to talk to things outside the processor. Let's just use that same protocol, that same design, to talk to things that aren't just storing data. So to use this, the operating system, you know, just accesses particular memory locations, and some details, you know, needs to know what the device controller expects, may need to disable caching by the processor because these locations, you know, because these locations don't store cacheable, you know, data like the rest of memory. So then there's a question about this with buffer. So this is memory mapped I/O from the sort of question about buffer. So some devices, device controllers, often need to store data, you know, that either hasn't been processed by the OS yet, or hasn't been processed by the device yet. So hasn't been processed by the OS yet is like, e.g., key presses I've made that the OS hasn't received yet, or hasn't been processed by the device would be, e.g., like stuff that needs to go out on the network but hasn't yet. So the device controllers need a place to store that data. So sometimes the device controllers will have some built-in storage for this, and that is a buffer on the device controller. Sometimes the device controller will ask the OS to point to what storage should be used for this. And that was the direct memory access scenario. Okay. Similarly, the operating system often needs to store data that either has been written by a program but not sent to the device controller yet, or has been received from the device controller but not sent to a program yet, you know, not received by a program yet. It will usually have its own kernel buffers for this. Which can be in addition, especially when there's not direct memory access to the device's buffers. Question. What happens if there's a buffer overflow? So it depends where, but we need to decide what we're going to do. So I guess as an example, like, it depends on the type of device. So like, if I have something like a keyboard, right? If I run out of buffer space, I probably need to either allocate more or I'm losing key presses. If we think of something like, like a audio output, right? If I can't really run out of buffer space because kind of like what I'm putting there is being output right now, right? If I don't have put something there, you know, there's no sense in like having extra space, right? That just doesn't make sense in that scenario. But it's going to depend on the scenario. If we talk about like a network device, like maybe we just lose data if we don't have enough space to put it somewhere. Or if we're sending things out on the network, maybe we just tell the program, sorry, you can't write to the network right now if we run out of space. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Quiz for week 14. this one? Yes, okay. So quiz 14, questions 2 and 4. Okay. So I disagree that question 2 is not about transactions, but we will deal with that. 2 is about failure. So question 2 is, the scenario is that we have a set enrollment 150 call and the previous value of the enrollment is 140. And this call appears to fail because the network breaks. So we have a couple scenarios. So one scenario, so scenario one is we sent the call out and it didn't get anywhere, and that's why it failed. In that case, value is still 140. Scenario two is we sent the call out, it got to the machine, but the response, the acknowledgement, didn't get anywhere, where the value is 150. Scenario three is we sent the call out, it got to the machine, or sent the call out, but the network took an exceptionally long time to get it there, and we gave up. We gave up. So the value was 140, but then it actually got there, even though we had given up on the network. We had guessed the network wouldn't take this long, the value became 150. Questions? Yeah.
For options B and C, or more specifically, option B, wouldn't the querying happen before, option B and C could be to the same effect, but only because of a different varying time?
Question, option B and C, aren't they very similar? So if we were looking at what the value was before, as we were making the call, we would definitely see 140, yes. But the sort of scenario of the question is future calls to get enrollment. So after we detect the error, what happens? And what we're saying is that when we decide to give up, that may be before or after the network actually sends something. Yes. Question? No. Okay. Okay. So then we have question 4. So question 4 is saying we have a transaction involving machine A1 and B1, and the coordinator fails during this transaction. And that question is asking what can happen before the coordinator recovers. And the key thing to remember is that we have to leave this transaction as pending, but we can do any operation that doesn't interfere. And there were transactions that involve other items on the machines, other items and orders, that's what we were dealing with, that definitely won't interfere. So there are some transactions involving machine B1 and A2, which shouldn't have any interference, so we can complete transactions. We can't complete every single possible transaction, but we can complete a lot of transactions. In fact, if you chose a random item and a random customer, probably you can do it. It's unlikely to conflict by X. And the same thing for B. That yes, it's true there, with the specific customer or order, we might have a problem where we can't actually do something, but if we choose a random or item from the items on the machine and a random customer from the customers on the machines, likely it's fine. Yeah.
Question says the transaction pending with that item, and then tries to do something with that same item, but it could be one item left. Would that coordinator tell that coordinator that
So the question is, what would happen if we have a conflict where we say, oh, we ran out of inventory. If both of these transactions commit, we run out of inventory. So the machine the machine that tracks that inventory, we need to tell sort of the second coordinator we talk to that either we need to say, you know, I can't tell you whether this transaction will work yet. And that could manifest, you know, the simplest way that can manifest, it could say, I can't do this now, abort. Or it could just wait until the transaction finishes to reply or something like that. But there would be questions, it would have to notify the coordinator. It has to tell the coordinator that, like, I can't tell you what the outcome of this is right now. Right? Because it can't tell you, is this successful or is this out of inventory? What's the result?
Because
it knows that it has to worry about the other transaction, whether that will come in or not. Yes.
So does it know that, like you said, some of the transactions, so does that know that because the corner machine that knows has the transaction is dollar, so it can essentially figure out what
it's on. So the question is, how can we figure out the other transactions can complete? So in the best implementation of the system, as part of agreeing to commit to the transaction, A1 and B1 would have recorded what the transaction's supposed to do. And they would have recorded that in their log because they, you know, need to make sure they don't forget it. And they could refer to that information. Does that answer your question? Quick question is, would it be a log on the item itself? So we didn't talk in detail about what the structure of the log is, and I'm not actually sure what the best approaches for that are when we have multiple concurrent transactions. But there are systems that support multiple concurrent transactions, and we just have to write things down on the disk in a way where we can figure out what parts belong to what transactions. Does that answer your question? Other questions? I didn't write my notes. So the question asks, the options say can complete transactions. They can't complete every possible transaction. Possible transaction, but they can complete transactions. They can definitely complete transactions involving the same machines, but different customers' items. Because there's no reason for a conflict. Transactions, not can complete any transaction. Okay, so then set user ID. Okay, so set user ID. So normally when I run a program, you know, when I exec via program, you know, the process's user ID stays the same. This means that, you know, e.g., if I run ls, it can access the same files I can normally access. But we can mark a program as set user ID. When I exec a set user ID program, the process's user ID becomes the user ID of the owner. This means that can access whatever, you know, is assigned, the owner's UID, user ID represents. The most common example, sort of common example, is set user ID programmed owned by user ID 0. Since user, this means that program can access anything, since user ID 0 skips most access control checks. Even though a normal program we run can only access the things I'm allowed to access. And the whoever sets up, the system administrator who sets up this program, you know, chooses carefully what programs they set this way to make sure it's only programs that allow things they want. Yes. So what I mean by owner, so the owner is the sort of user ID stored, sort of a special user ID stored with the file, which typically, you know, in POSIX, the user ID that has permission to change the access control list. The same user ID is used for that purpose, used for the purpose of deciding what user ID to change to. They could have decided to make it a separate field, but they didn't do that. Question is basically always zero. It's whoever, so the it's a user ID that's marked in the file system. Usually if, so the default owner of a file is the user ID that creates it. So a lot of files will have user ID 0 as their owner, but that's because they were probably because they were created by a program running as user ID 0. But if you create a file, it will have as its owner your user ID. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and that's everything I had listed down, so yes. Sorry? Sure.
Capabilities still occur in the kernel, and or do they just mitigate the valid logic?
So question, do capabilities still occur in the kernel? So yes. So capabilities sort of have to be managed by the kernel, you know, to, you know, the kernel has to do the kernel uses them to look up, you know, what resource does this capability refer to? Or two, and if the kernel doesn't do that, then, well, you know, I guess kernel or something trusted at least has to do that, right? Because we can't let the attacker control this, or they can make up this, or they can make up, you know, new tokens for anything, right? So something trusted needs to do that, and typically that would be the kernel. In the Unix design, it would definitely be the kernel. There's some other OS designs where we might have some other trusted components that aren't the kernel, that aren't running in kernel mode. And the sort of main advantage of capabilities, sort of capabilities, is probably a cleaner interface rather than a performance one. It's hard to say because sort of a lot of how the code, because like for, you know, if your goal is to have something like access control list, well, implementing it with capability is probably going to be slower. But if you have a capability-based system, probably that's maybe not quite your goal, but your goal is also probably not quite, you know, it's probably not the most natural thing with either capabilities or access control list. You probably have some policies that are complicated. So it's hard to say which is faster. But like the usual argument for capabilities is that it's a cleaner interface and therefore harder to mess up, easier to do certain things like delegate responsibility from one program to another. And that's usually the argument for it. Yeah.
How does sudo
question, how does sudo administer accounts? So sudo is an example of a set user ID program. So the system administrator sets up sudo, and it trusts that sudo is going to do the checks it wants to do before it lets you do something dangerous. So password checking, so password checking, in the Unix design, the kernel knows nothing about passwords, or usernames. Instead, programs the system administrator sets up, do this work, and they tell the kernel, what user ID to run things as based on, their database of usernames and passwords. Does that answer that question? In question, what layers or access control is? Question, why would I not use access control list for certain things? So the access control list just doesn't provide the functionality you want. So that's the main reason you definitely wouldn't use them, right? Because access control list just can't do certain things. Question is that why we use set user ID and all that sort of thing? Yes. So a set user ID program that does printing can enforce that restriction. It can count pages, it can keep a database of how many pages you've printed this month, for example, and it could enforce that. And there's other ways we can imagine doing that too. Like, I could run a server that you contact with a password, and it could do that too, but you know, access control lists just don't provide they don't have a write only 10 pages field, right? Question, how would those set user ID programs be created? So even though I don't recommend it, well, some people do it. I guess my not recommending it advice is more that if you want to do it, you need to do a lot of research. And I guess if you are in this position of being a system administrator of a machine and you need a more practical way, you know, of like giving someone special access, there are things you can do that are kind of don't involve writing your own set user ID program. Like sudo has a configuration file. You can write things in that configuration file to give people access to certain commands. And that might be a more practical way that doesn't involve you determining how many ways you can write a set user ID program. Otherwise, yes, people write set user ID programs, but you just want to think hard about how you're writing them. And the same sort of things apply, actually, if you like write a server that runs as root that people connect to, right? Because like, you have to worry about, are people going to call this server in weird ways I didn't expect? But it's just especially weird for set user ID programs because I mentioned you can do things like run it with standard out closed. How does your program behave then? Well, we need to think about that. But people have done this. That's why sudo exists. That it's meant to run as a set user ID program is how it works. Other questions? Okay, so I guess we're all set. I'm just